Welcome to Pardes Daily, where you get your daily dose of Torah with Pardes faculty. This month, Pardes is bringing Elul to you. Let's dive in.
Hi, this is Rachel Berkovitz coming to you from Jerusalem. This is Unit 19 of 20, in which we're learning through all the Mishnayot of Masechet Rosh Hashanah. We're towards the end of the fourth chapter, and we saw last times that, first of all, in the beginning of the chapter, where was the decrees of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai? We saw the repeating words over and over again. The word Mikdash, holiness, was repeated 6 times, and the word Yom, day, was repeated 7 times. And then when we got to Mishnah 5, which looked like it sort of took a break and jumped away from it, we saw that the key phrase in the structure of the prayer, and prayer also was another model in which the Jewish people found a way to connect to the divine without the temple. The key phrase was this blessing of Kedushat Hayom, of the sanctity of the day. And we learned that in the structure of Tefillah, which had 3 blessings at the beginning and 3 blessings at the end, the middle blessing of this sanctity of the day got split into 3 blessings about kingship, memory, and shofar. And we need to learn more about these 3 blessings. So Mishnah Vav continues. It says the following: Ein pochtim me'asara malchiot, me'asara zichronot, me'asara shofarot. You don't do less than 10, and here the most important word is not mentioned in the Mishnah, less than 10 verses from our holy canon. You don't do less than 10 verses that relate to the topic of divine kingship. You don't do less than 10 verses that relate to the concept of divine memory, the memory that the divine has for the Jewish people. And you don't do less than 10 verses that discuss the concept of the blowing of shofar. Okay, this is interesting. So we have a concept of 10 verses, and we talked about the idea that prayer is made up of brachot, is made up of blessings. That's the terminology that the rabbis use. But another thing that really is the building blocks and basis for prayer, right? How does a human being call out to the divine? How does a human being know the words in which to use to call out to praise the divine or thank the divine or make requests of the divine? And a model that the original building blocks of tefillah had is verses from the Torah, right? We see it with Birkat Kohanim, the priestly blessing. We see it if you know the Kedusha that is said in the repetition of the silent, after we do a silent Amidah and then we do it publicly. Those are made up of verses. And many of the blessings that we say have verses in them, and verses were the building blocks of the original brachot. So here this text says, I'm going to give you a structure for these special, unique blessings that you're going to do on Rosh Hashanah, and they need to be made up of verses. And we're going to find out in a moment what kind of verses. Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, our same Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri from Mishnah 5, he has a slightly different view. He says you don't need to do 10. 10 is a lot. He says, Imamar shalosh shalosh mikulam yetza. If you say 3 of 3 for each one, 3 for each 3, for each set of 3, meaning 3 verses for Malchiyot, 3 verses Zechronot, 3 verses Shofarot, right? The 3 special blessings of Rosh Hashanah, and if everyone has 3, then Yetzah, you fulfilled your obligation. Now, we learned something interesting with the word Yetzah here, that there is an individual obligation. We didn't know yet if these blessings were done communally, if it was on the individual that had to recite them, if it was just on the prayer leader, and now we find out that there is an individual obligation to do these things, and it maybe is a bit much for the individual to come up with 10. So a minimum of 3 would be okay. The question is if those 3 have to be 1 from the Torah, 1 from the Navi, from the prophets, and 1 from the writings. Some people understand it that way, and that's how our tefillah is structured today. The Mishnah doesn't state it that way. I mean, possibly that's his meaning of 3. And here, this idea that we have 3 of 3, and then possibly that 3 turns into a 10, the play of these numbers, we're going to see these numbers again in the last Mishnah when we're talking about blasts, right? It's clear already from Mishnah Hay that there's a link between the blessings and the blast. And we're going to see it in the literary structure between the link of the numbers of the blast and the blessings are going to be the same, and the link between the use of the word Seder in both places. It's interesting to note, if you want a side note, if you know anything about the public Torah reading, we also have this structure. 3 aliyot, minimum of 3 verses each, and then the minimum of a public Torah reading has to be 10. So the 3 that is 10, we see that as well. You can see that in Masechet Megillah chapter 4. So these numbers seem to be of importance. Then the text goes on. Ein maskirin zichron Machut v'shofar shoporiniot. Don't mention a memory or a kingship or a shofar verse. We're talking about the verse that refers to punishment, right? That it can't be a verse that says something negative about the divine punishing Israel. We're going to come back to this line in a Mishnah. I just want to finish the Mishnah. Matchil b'torah u'mishalim b'navi. Rabbi Yossi omer im hishlim b'torah yetzah. And in the structure of these blessings, how should I do it? I should start with verses from the Torah itself, from the five books of Moses, and then I should end it, I should complete it with verses from the prophets. And different commentators here don't know if this means specifically prophets as opposed to writings, or there is a view that possibly in the Tanaitic literature, in the literature from the time period of the Mishnah, that there isn't a distinction between the prophets and the writings, and the Navi refers to that entire canon, anything that isn't Torah. And so there's an order. I have a hierarchy. I first do Torah, and then I finish with something outside of Torah. Rabbi Yossi says, "Im hishlim b'Torah yetsa." If I complete it with a verse from the Torah, no problem. Some people understand that he's actually saying that's even the ideal. And once again, it emphasizes that there's an individual obligation. Let's go back to that middle line, that sort of linchpin in the middle of the text, where it says, "Ein maskirin zichron machut v'shofar shoparinot." So first of all, now we have that word maskirin again, right? We saw it zecher lemikdash in Mishnah 3. We saw Rabbi Akiva in Mishnah 5 saying, "Why, if you're not going to mention it, right? This maskir, why, if you're not going to blow, why mention it?" And now we have the word maskirin, don't mention, referring to verse. Verses. But when we're saying mentioning, right, we're talking about announcing with our lips, declaring, it actually means saying the bracha or saying the tefillah. That's what the mentioning is. And then we see that the order is out of order. Usually it was kingship, memory, shofar. And now it has memory, kingship, shofar. And obviously this flip, and if you check the manuscripts, this seems to be the correct way it is to juxtapose the word maskirim with the word zikaron, right? Mentioning and memory. Obviously there's a link. I mention something, I declare something verbally, and then it enables me to remember it. It brings it to my consciousness. And it seems to be that it's clear by doing this double play and by having the words Maskir and Zikaron throughout the whole chapter, that this is an essential theme. And possibly it's the essential theme that helps us understand what these blessings are about, because the Mishnah doesn't really tell us what these verses are supposed to be about or what the blessings are supposed to be about. Now, we do have a phrase in the Torah that refers to Rosh Hashanah, the words Rosh Hashanah not mentioned in the Torah, remember, but it's a Yom Zichron Truah, a Yom of remembering blasts or causing memory through blasts, right? We say it memory of blasts, but possibly it's causing memory through blasts, because that seems to be the structure that's set up here with these blessings. And so, and we learned something else. We're not supposed to mention anything that has to do with these topics that's negative, i.e. the purpose of these things is to have something positive. It's supposed to be something good, warm, happy. And I want to remind you that the link between shofar and yovel, we're going to talk about this in a moment in the next Mishnah, is also the yovel is announcing, is declaring, and there too the idea of remembering. It wasn't a negative idea. It wasn't an unhappy day. And nowhere in the Mishnah does it really present the blast as something unhappy. They're rather something possibly even we're going to see in a moment called Yom Tov, something joyous. And so we need these to be positive verses. And it seems to be the idea is, if we want to look at the structure, is I acknowledge the divine as king. I accept the divine as the ruler of the universe and what controls that cycle of life in the first chapter. And then I recite verses that mention places where the divine remembered the Jewish people. And I say those kind of as a bakasha, as a request to say, and please remember us now in the present. And then I say verses about the shofar, and the shofar is supposed to create, it seems to be the verb or the action that is supposed to create, to jostle the memory of the divine, to poke the memory of the divine so that the divine will remember us for good. And that seems to be the structure. Okay, Mishnah Zion is going to continue with the theme of telling us something about the relationship to the blast and the blessings and the synagogue structure. Mishnah Zion, although we learned in Mishnah Vav that there's an individual obligation of these blessings. Mishnah Zayin says, Over lifnei hateva, the one that passes before the ark. And this is another way to say the prayer leader. This is now referring to some type of service that is happening with an ark in the synagogue. There's a repetition of it, and there's some type of communal prayer as well. There are a number of ways you could say the prayer leader. At the end of the chapter, we're going to see the word shaliach tzibor, the messenger, the prayer of the community. Here, to pass before the ark means the individual moves from their seat and goes and stands before the ark. Obviously, the link of the ark goes to the verses, right? Inside the ark is the Torah. And there seems to be some link between the Torah and Torah as a place, as a source of calling out to the divine, of praising or reminding the divine. And here too, to stand before the ark means to stand before the divine in some way, to stand before the Torah and to focus oneself on the divine. And that is what the experience of prayer is. And we're going to juxtapose that in a second with the second half of the Mishnah. So, Over lifnei hateva, biyom tov shel Rosh Hashanah, on the Yom Tov, right? And here we have that phrase that we had in the first Mishnah, on the holy day, on the Yom Simcha, on the happy day of Rosh Hashanah. And here too, we could have deleted the word Yom Tov, but it seems like it's the Mishnah wants us to hear it. Hasheni Matkia, the second prayer leader, i.e. the one of Musaf, blows. And here there is a dispute about how to understand the blows. Is it the actual prayer leader is the one who blows? In a second, if we parallel it to the second half of the Mishnah, it seems like it's the prayer leader who should be doing it. On the other hand, there's a very strong tradition going back that it's not the prayer leader who blows, but that the prayer leader causes the one who is blowing to blow, and that there's some reciprocity between the prayer leader and the blower, and the relationship between the blessings and the blowing, and it's not the same person, but I will leave that open. The pshat sounds like it is the same person, the strong ancient tradition that it's not the same person. Ubashat halel, and at the time of halel, and now this doesn't mean on Rosh Hashanah, because there isn't halal in Rosh Hashanah, meaning at the times when halal is recited on other festivals, harishon makre et halal, the first prayer leader is the one that reads the halal. So the minimal thing that this Mishnah is telling us is that the shofar blowing happens in Musaf with the second prayer leader, as opposed to when we have Hallel, which doesn't happen on Rosh Hashanah, but happens on other festivals in which the shacharit, the first prayer leader, does Hallel. So this is an interesting juxtaposition. Why bring Hallel into the story in the first place? It seems to be creating some type of parallel between Hallel and shofar blowing, as if to say that the shofar blowing on Rosh Hashanah is like the Hallel on other days, right? And Hallel is there to exalt the divine, to sing praises to the divine. And then it makes it seem like that the shofar blowing is some type of singing praises or exalting the divine. That's its ofi, that's its character. That is also seems to be this link to Hallel is to come and to explain why Rosh Hashanah is a Yom Tov, right? Normally other holidays are called the Yom Tov, a holiday, because we have Hallel on them, because they're joyous occasions, because we're happy about something. And it seems to be that this use of the word Yom Tov is a reflective of the halal experience, which is somehow reflected in the shofar blowing, right? And it's interesting to note that both halal and shofar, their original sources, once again, are in the temple. The halal was said on the joyous occasions to accompany the tamid shel shachar, to accompany the morning sacrifice that was done in the temple. That's why it's in the shacharit service. But that's when it was done. It was done in a temple to accompany the sacrifice. And the shofar, as we saw, was also done to accompany a sacrifice. Now we're post-temple. We don't have sacrifices. And the halel and the shofar accompany the tefillah, which takes the place, accompany the prayer service, which takes the place of the sacrifices, right? Sacrifices, korbanot, bring us closer to the divine. Tefillah brings us closer to the divine. And so we have this interesting structure that gives us another hint about what the shofar is. It creates a joyous occasion. It somehow exalts the divine. And through exalting the divine, we want the divine to remember us and acknowledge us and hopefully judge us for good, judge us for all that cycle of life that this is going to be the beginning of, the water, the land, the animals, the plants. Okay. That is Mishnah Zayin. Now, we learned that one aspect of the Yom Tov, right, was maybe the shofar blowing, was this this, it's a holiday. Another aspect of what makes something a Yom Tov in the Torah is that Melechet Avodah Lo Tasu, that you shouldn't do creative acts, that we refrain from doing creative acts, that there is an Isur Melecha, is an aspect of making something a Yom Tov. And the next Mishnah, Mishnah Chet, is going to focus on that aspect. It's going to go back to the idea that there's prohibited acts in some way. And we saw, okay, so Mishnah Chet says, Shofar Shel Rosh Hashanah. And so here now we have a phrase similar, the shofar of Rosh Hashanah. We have the phrase Shel Rosh Hashanah mirrored in the from the Mishnah before. The shofar Shel Rosh Hashanah. And now it's going to give us a list of things that we don't do for the shofar. And these things are going to be prohibited acts, right? So here's the question. To make a holy day of Rosh Hashanah, there are creative acts we're not supposed to do. And to make a holy day of Rosh Hashanah, we're supposed to blow the shofar. We're going to learn, and obviously it's clear that the divine asks us to blow the shofar on this holiday, so it's permitted. But am I allowed to, in some ways, transgress Rosh Hashanah to enable me to blow the shofar? Right? I learned that I was allowed to transgress Shabbat, and all the more so Rosh Hashanah if it's the Rosh Chodesh Tishrei, right, if for the Edim to come. And I learned at the beginning of the chapter when I could transgress Shabbat to blow the shofar. But now I've learned that there's I know from chapter 3 that there's an individual obligation to blow the shofar. Am I allowed to do acts that I'm normally not allowed to do on Yom Tov to enable me to blow the shofar? That's the question we're going to address. And then it says the following, Ein mavirim alav et hatchum. We don't allow them to transgress the boundary of travel, right? That you're not allowed to go farther than that alpaya mama, that 2,000 ama. Remember we saw in the second chapter this issue with the Edim that they got to the town and they weren't going to be allowed to move, and that was going to prevent them from coming. And so we said, we'll expand it. You can be like a person in the town and you can travel this the distance that you're normally allowed to travel. And we said that also applied to like the midwife and to people to come saving a life, right? Remember that? So here, if I need to get a shofar, I'm not allowed to go past that boundary. And I am not allowed to remove stones or dismantle stones if the shofar is hiding underneath. To save a life, I'm allowed to do the same phrase as used, but I'm not allowed to do that if the shofar is hiding underneath. Below olim al be'ilan, and I'm not allowed to climb a tree. Below rachvim al gabi behima, and I'm not allowed to ride on a horse, remember, or a donkey, or any type of animal, domesticated animal, right? Remember in chapter 1, the Edim were allowed to travel and break Shabbat by riding. And I'm not allowed to swim in the water or create some type of raft in the water. And I'm not allowed to cut or form it. Remember in chapter 3, maybe I need to fix the shofar. And I'm not allowed to do the bane, but whether the type of action and utensil I'm using is only going to transgress something rabbinically, or whether it's going to be something that is going to be an actual biblical transgression. But if I want to just pour water or wine into my shofar, which apparently that could soften it and it could affect the voice, the coal, the sound that the shofar made, it can improve it, I'm allowed to. Okay, so we have to quickly look at this list. Now, what's interesting about this list is the large majority of things, possibly except for the removing the stones, are all rabbinic mitzvot. They're all rabbinic decrees of rabbinic additions that the rabbi said don't do. Right? The Torah says a list of certain specific things you're not allowed to do, and then there's a rabbinic expansion of that. Right? The Babylonian Talmud refers to them all as shvut, like the Mishnah used that thing, sheva al taseh, something you're not supposed to refrain from doing. The Yerushalmi defines them all as uvdin dechol, behaviors that we usually do on weekdays, and we're not supposed to do them. And so this is interesting. I maybe have a biblical mitzvah of shofar, or possibly if we want to understand it from this chapter, that it's part of the decree that we're continuing post-temple and it's a rabbinic mitzvah of shofar. But this mitzvah shofar, which we know is so essential to this day, does not enable me to transgress rabbinic mitzvot, rabbinic enactments, rabbinic decrees to enable me to blow it. right, to get it. I need to be prepared. I need to have planned to have it beforehand or fix it up beforehand. And that's the first part of the Mishnah. This first little bit of the Mishnah ends with something about improving its voice, and we're allowed to improve the sound of the shofar, right? The action of pouring water is not a creative act. There's nothing wrong with it, even though it betters the shofar. That's allowed. And then we segue into another section that's kind of awkward in this Mishnah. It sounds like it's talking about something else. Now we're going to focus on the sound and on the blowing. So I'm not allowed to do preparatory acts, but I'm for sure allowed to blow. Just blowing a musical instrument's thumb for no reason would be a rabbinic prohibition. But blowing it for a mitzvah action to create the kol mitzvah, the voice of a mitzvah of shofar and Rosh Hashanah, obviously is permitted. That isn't a rabbinic violation. But if I'm doing it for mitzvah. But now I find out that I don't need to prevent children from blowing, i.e. children aren't obligated in mitzvot yet. You might have thought that that would be a rabbinic prohibition and they shouldn't blow. But I say, no, I can allow them. Rather, not only can I allow them to practice their blowing, I can involve myself with them so that they'll learn. And that seems, involving myself with them seems to imply I can blow the shofar myself. And so now I learn that obviously the voice of a shofar that's a mitzvah action is permitted, but something that is going to educate towards mitzvah actions is also considered part of that mitzvah, or is permitted, right? And so here's a link of being prepared. Another way to prepare people to do mitzvot is educate them throughout their lives to be prepared, right? And what's very interesting is I don't prevent them from blowing. That reminds me of the don't prevent the edim from coming. Remember, we thought if there were too many edim, Rabbi Akiva thought, I'll stop them from coming. And Rabbi Gamliel says, no, don't prevent them from coming, because I want the nation to feel connected. I want people to feel that they have a responsibility. And so here I think it's a similar idea. I don't want to stop kids from getting excited about shofar and practicing shofar, because I want them to feel connected. And so that when the time comes for them to do the mitzvah, they'll be willing and able and jump up and ready to do it, and they'll be prepared. And so I can involve myself with them. And then the Mishnah continues and says, but I'm allowed to blow for them to help them to teach, right? And there's a link between mitaskim, where I'm involving myself in helping them learn the mitzvah, and this word mitasek, which means I'm just kind of blowing for my own reason, but not for the reason, like I'm involved in the blowing, but I'm not doing it. I don't have that kavanah talev. I don't have the intention that I saw in the third chapter to fulfill the mitzvah. So if I'm just tooting, but I'm not doing it for a mitzvah purpose, I cannot fulfill my obligation. And that's linked to the end of the third chapter. And then the one who heard the blowing, right? If the blower didn't have the right kavanah, as we know, and is not thinking about it, right? Then the one who heard from him also does not fulfill his obligation. So at the end of the third chapter, we've heard about the listener and what kind of kavanah the listener has to have if they traveled behind a synagogue or passing behind a synagogue. Here, we're focusing on the blower, and the blower has to also do it l'shem mitzvah, for the purpose of the mitzvah, and has to be focused on that. And if not, he can't fulfill his obligation. And one who hears the call, even though it sounds the same, the voice, if the kavanah is there, it's not. And so here too, although we see that there's an individual obligation in shofar blowing, we are emphasizing the link to the other. I can fulfill other people's obligations. I can help kids learn in this duality between the individual and the many, which we saw in the third chapter. We're going to see continuing here in the end of this chapter. The one last thing I wanted to add here about this Mishnah that I think is fascinating, right? The way we created a Yom Tov, a holy day, Yom Kodesh of Rosh Hashanah, right? Was we learned this in that linchpin Mishnah of the fourth Mishnah, right? We were noheg kedusha. We human beings created kedusha, right? And we, the human beings, have the power to create our relationship with the divine. Right. And that human creation is holiness in this world, creates holiness of time. And so what's really interesting to me about this Mishnah, that it was talking all about rabbinic enactments. Right. And that to do this mitzvah shofar, I cannot break a rabbinic enactment. It seems to be saying something, the same thing about Torah. Right. You might think that rabbinic Torah is not equal to divine Torah. that human-made Torah doesn't have the same power. But this Mishnah comes along and says it does. Just the way human beings can create holiness, human beings create Torah. And we saw that with all the takanot of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And now we're seeing it here again with the rabbis creating holiness by expounding the boundaries of what of the behaviors that one cannot do on a Yom Tov, on a holy day, so that that day feels different than weekdays. Okay, with the next session, we're going to finish the chapter and focus on the tikkiot and again on this relationship between the individual and the community.
Thank you to our Pardes faculty. And thank you to you, our learners. Make sure to check back in at the beginning of each week to stay on track with your Elul learning. And visit www.pardes.org.il for more information about Pardes and our programs.